Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Stone Chapel, a podcast of the staff and friends of the Lanier Theological Library in Houston, Texas. My name is David Capes. I'm the Senior Research Fellow at the Library and your host for this series of podcasts. Our purpose is fairly simple. We want to bring to you great conversations with leading experts from around the world on biblical, theological, historical, and archaeological themes. Well, the list goes on. So sit back, relax, and enjoy. Joining me today on the Stone Chapel, Dr. Craig Evans, the John Bisogno Distinguished Professor of Christian Origins at the School of Christian Thought at Houston Baptist University. He's the author of about 600 articles, I think, and over 70 books, most of which you can find at the Lanier Theological Library. Dr. Evans, thanks for being a part of this.
Thank you, David, very, very much. Good to be with you.
I think it was 20 years ago, I was at the University of Manchester at the John Rylands Library and had an opportunity to see a document called P52, Papyrus 52, which was, at that point, the earliest fragment of any New Testament document out there is the Gospel of John. It's about the size of the palm of your hand. It's this beautiful honey-colored papyrus written front and back, so we know it's a codex. And that was the earliest. And I think people were dating that to 125. Now, not long ago, I remember hearing that we may have an earlier fragment of the New Testament in the Gospel of Mark. And you were sort of implicated in that, and people ask you about it, and people want to know about it. So let's tell that story a little bit and tell us what we really are dealing with now with this early fragment on the Gospel of Mark.
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's a complicated and somewhat convoluted story behind it. In the early 1980s, Revel Coles, or as he usually goes when he publishes, R.A. Coles, an Oxford papyrologist who has many, many edited papyri in the Oxford, well-known Oxford series called the Oxyrhynchus Papyri. Anyway, he identified a single leaf of Greek text, piece of papyrus, and he put a little note card with it that said, late 1st, early 2nd century. He wasn't sure what it was, but it was based on the way some of the letters that he could see clearly, the way they looked. Well, now fast forward about 25 years, and Oxford papyrologist Dirk Obink fished it out of the box, and
it literally is a box.
Yeah, it's
right?
Kind of like these big, these large rectangular-shaped Tupperware boxes.
I wonder where all that Tupperware went.
Yeah, I was in the Griffiths Papyri Lab. It's in the Sackler Rare Books, Ancient Books, part of the Bodleian, working with Jeremiah Johnston, who's was doing work on that. And so we had the opportunity to, on various occasions, to be there. One time, Dirk Obink was there with us, and he started opening up these wooden cupboards and started pulling out these, like I describe them. I don't know how else to describe them. I don't think they are Tupperware, literally, but they look like that.
Look
these,
like that.
Boxes just filled with papyri. And anyway, so that's what happened. He was going through one of these boxes, and of course there are these annotations, and this one, as I just said, was annotated by R.A. Coles as late 1st, early 2nd century. So he looked at it and decided to see if he could identify what the text was, because many of the letters are just almost impossible to see. But the technology, the microscopes, the kind of light enhancement they can do for seeing images more clearly, that technology obviously has improved a lot in the last 35 years. And so he realized, he must have been just stunned, he realized he was looking at a page from the Gospel of Mark.
And not so, just some random...
Yeah, it wasn't just some text, any old text. And so it was a pieces of a couple of verses, I think verse 7, verse 8. On one side, he flips the page over, pieces of verses 13, 14, something like that.
So what does it mean when you see it on both sides of the page?
Well, like you stated, David, in your introduction a moment ago, with reference to P52, when you see writing on both sides, And by both sides, let me clarify something. A lot of times you'll have a single piece of papyrus and it's a letter and it's written on both sides, maybe the first side, the whole page, and then you turn it over and it's half a page. But you know what you find when it's a single page? They turn it sideways when they write on the back side. You know why? It's because of the way papyrus is made. There's strips of papyrus pressed together. And the front side, or what we call the recto, is called that because the papyrus strips go horizontally. And they're much easier to write on.
Easier to write on that, yeah. Right.
You don't want to write across the grain. You want to write on top of it, along with it. And so when it's a single page and they have to go ahead and write on the next page because the letter or document, whatever we're talking about, is just too long, can't be confined to a single sheet, when they flip the page over, they then turn it sideways so they can still write with the grain. Because on the back side of a piece of papyrus, the grain is going vertically, up and down. They call it the verso. So when you find a fragment and it's written on both sides, and so when you flip it over, it's still going horizontally across the grain on the back. That's when you know, oh, this was a page in a book. You can't turn the page and then turn the book sideways. They just keep writing level as they turn the pages. So that tells us, oh, this is from a codex. Codex from originally meaning a stack of waxed boards, tablets, on which notes used to be taken. And that's the forerunner that became the book, which today is what we use. Yeah. And Christians love that. And so it's now widely believed that the Christian preference for the codex form, as opposed to the scroll or book roll, had a huge impact over the development of the book. Because in the second and third centuries, Christian writings tended to be codex, and non-Christian writings still seem to prefer the book roll. So that's an interesting observation we make. So here's this page, the single leaf. It's not very large. It's not the full page. It's only a portion of the page, badly decomposed. And you flip it over, and it's a continuous text running across the grain. And so we know, okay, this is a page out of a gospel codex. This is a page, at the very least, out of originally a booklet that contained the Gospel of Mark. And this was an astounding find. And here's where it gets really interesting. Obink, of course, was stunned by this. Could it really be late 1st or early 2nd century, as Coles originally thought, not knowing it was Mark? And so Obink looked carefully at the letters that were visible that he could see, and for a while he remained convinced it is late 1st century. And he discussed this with David Trobisch, and I know David Trobisch as well, and for a time David Trobisch worked for the Green family in the Museum of the Bible. And so he pointed out to Trobisch, and I discussed this later with Trobisch, that, you know, there are some letter forms here that were common in the first century but aren't represented in the second, or they're rare in the second. At least that was the talk. Now, this is 10 years ago. And that's where all this rumor got started, back when it was announced, I believe, in 2012. When a representative for the Museum of the Bible told the well-known textual critic Dan Wallace at Dallas Theological Seminary, who has his manuscript center and takes these beautiful photographs of Greek manuscripts. And so Dan, he looked at the text and talked it over with Obink. Trobisch had looked at the text, talked it over with Obink, and these various characteristics, and this is part of what's called paleography, which just basically means analyzing old handwriting. And that's where this idea is, that this fragment of Mark is late first century. Now, where they got the idea that it should be dated to the 80s specifically, and that was talked about for years.
That's pretty specific when you get to a certain decade, right?
Yeah, that's very specific. In fact, actually, David, and I know you know this, but a lot of papyrologists and textual critics don't like specifically dating P52 to 125.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really a kind of an approximation date. And that goes all the way back to Colin Roberts when he did work on P52 back in the 1930s. And he consulted with several handwriting experts, paleographers of his time, Europeans and Brits and so on. And he got a date range that went from about 90, believe it or not, that early, to about 140, 150, something like that.
So plus or minus.
Yeah. And he, what he did was he said, okay, let's just split the difference.
Yeah.
And that's where that 125 came from. And so a truly competent textual critic or papyrologist would never say P52 dates to 125.
Right, right.
What they typically would say is it dates probably to the first half of the second century.
Yeah. So about a 50-year spread.
Yeah,
50.
Yeah. And some people will say, well, why don't you just do carbon 14? Well, that doesn't do any better. In fact, more often than not, yeah, paleography can narrow down a text better than C14.
Mm-hmm.
A lot
mm-hmm.
of people don't know that.
So how did you get involved in all of this? What was happening that...
Well, you know,
somehow
I did,
Craig.
Yeah,
Evans.
How did I get involved? I didn't want to get involved. If the blogosphere didn't exist, if social media didn't exist, we wouldn't be talking about this.
Well, we might be, but on a different level.
But you know, I've been working for years on a book, which I'm happy to say now is in the press, called Jesus the Manuscripts. And so I was tracking down every single gospel manuscript that there was. And, of course, if there's a Mark fragment that possibly is older than the John fragment, P52, then, man, that's a big deal. So I contacted Dan Wallace February or March of 2012, just days after he had made this public announcement when he was debating somebody on are the gospel manuscripts reliable and so on. And the question came up, how early do we have to have, you know, samples of the New Testament before with confidence we can say the text is preserved? And it was in that setting that Dan sprang on his adversary, this Mark fragment. So I contacted Dan, and he said, well, he says, I've looked at it, I've seen it, I've talked. He said, I signed a non-disclosure agreement, so I can't give you all the details. Other than to say it could well be. I talked to a real live competent papyrologist, and of course it turns out that's Dirk Obink, but he honored his non-disclosure agreement, and of course then rumors started circulating. I heard from other sources that the Green family was thinking of buying this fragment, and of course the question was, well, where did the fragment come from? Who owns it?
What about in terms of provenance? Do we know where it came from exactly?
Well, today we believe, and this is the Egypt Exploration Society's own statement, it came from probably 1907 or something like that. One of the Grenfell Hunt excavations for papyri at Oxyrhynchus.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
They think they know which box originally it came from. But there was a little bit of obfuscation going on, and I want to be careful what I say because some of this will end up before the courts because, there was some illegal stuff going on, it would appear. And the rumor, it deceived a lot of us. The rumor was that it had been recovered from cartonnage. Hmm. That's paper mache from antiquity where it used papyrus and flour mixed with water. It's just like kids today in kindergarten.
Right, right.
And they make mummy masks and other pieces of, like, a bodice for the mummy's body and so on. They're shaped a certain way. They dry out. They paint them and so on and so on. Well, this cartonnage, of course, is made out of used papyrus. Used papyrus, by definition, is writing all over it. And as a matter of fact, from cartonnage, some old pieces of text have been recovered. I've
uh-huh.
seen them.
Uh-huh.
I've been in the lab in Oklahoma City that the Museum of the Bible owns, and I've seen papyrus that's been extracted from cartonnage, and there, you're just looking at it, and there it is.
Yeah, yeah.
Read the text. So anyway, that was the story. Most of us now think that the story's phony. It was a cover-up to try to create a new source of origin for this papyrus so that it could be, on somebody's behalf, be sold to the Green family. Anyway, the whole thing is blown up. It's estimated now at least 120 papyri have gone missing. Some of them, the Green family, of course, they're as honest as can be, and they have cooperated with the authorities. They've returned, I think it was something like 11 papyri that they had purchased or almost purchased. They've been returned to Oxford.
But that means there's still about 110 of them
there
somewhere.
Apparently so.
Right?
And, you know,
different
places. You know, for all I know, I'm out of date right now while I'm talking about it. But unfortunately, you know, we were all taken in by this story. And Dan Wallace was a straight shooter and honest, no deceit there at all. And he honored his non-disclosure agreement, which is what, you know, kind of kept things unknown for so long. But, you know, what else could he do? And so at a conference, and I believe it was in later that year, 2012, might have been the next year, I was talking about how old the papyri are that we have for the New Testament. And I ran through a bunch of examples, including P52. And I said, oh, by the way, there's a report coming out of Oxford that there is a fragment of the Gospel of Mark that could date to the end of the first century. So I referred to that. Now, of course, I didn't have a picture of the fragment, but and I said we were also told that it's been recovered from cartonnage, from paper mache, maybe a mummy mask. And so, and of course, I'm doing PowerPoint. And I have some pictures, and so I show this is what a mummy mask looks like that's made out of a cartonnage. Well, I didn't know it, but somebody was filming.
Oh, lovely!
Filming this presentation and then posted an edited portion of it on YouTube.
Mm.
And not
ask
right
your
away.
Permission, of course. I'm sure.
Yeah, right. I've been receiving royalties ever since. And I actually posted it, I think, rather late, or at least it didn't get noticed, but I think it was in 2014, so it's been at least 1 year, maybe two. And Owen Jarrus, who's a reporter for Live Science, which is an online journal, and usually very responsible. Owen's a good guy, and I've done stories with him before. He emailed me, and he said, what's this about recovering text from ancient paper mache? You know, this is interesting from a scientific point of view, how you can deconstruct the papyrus without wrecking the ink that's on the papyrus.
Exactly.
And yeah, I said that is interesting. Actually, it's some kind of a dish soap that's used. That's all it is. Mm. And for some reason, it doesn't harm the ink, and so the text remains very legible. So I told him everything I knew at that time, and he contacted a few others, and he ran a story. Well, it touched off a firestorm. I started getting this email from all over the place. And one of the things, part of the backstory here that I did not know about, where there was a groundswell of criticism that was beginning to grow, develop, directed against the Green family. The Museum of the Bible, of course, didn't exist yet. The property had been purchased. The building was just getting underway. It didn't open up until like 2017. But we're talking about now 2014, and right on into the next year, 2015, all these stories started circulating, and mostly online-type news things and blogs and so on. And there were all kinds of allegations made. I was accused of destroying museum-quality artifacts where I was at Acadia, Nova Scotia. And you know that place, David.
Uh-huh.
You were there yourself
right.
to give lectures a few years back. And I thought, what? What's going on? I've done no such thing. Then there were bloggers saying that Evans has dated the Mark fragment to the late first century. I thought, I didn't date. I what? I didn't. I'm not the one who dated it. What's going on? And anyway, all
you're just
this
reporting what you've heard from
this,
credible sources, right?
This just was driving me nuts.
Yeah.
And you know, I'm not even running for president, and I'm getting all this negative press and criticism. It's like, what
they've
in the world?
They've got a portfolio on you somewhere.
Yeah. A dossier is now being looked at by the FBI. And I said, what is going on here? Anyway, it finally started to cool off. And then in March of 2018, the papyrus was finally published. In that series I mentioned before that Oxford University Press publishes, and it's the Oxyrhynchus Papyri series.
So was it late first century, though?
Well, here's the thing. Okay, and so Dirk Obink and his associate there in the Griffith Lab, Daniela Colomo, they look at it, they discuss it, they say, well, yeah, a lot of the characteristics do point to the first century, but there are a few handwriting characteristics that suggest second century. And they, you know, and the what text critics call and papyrologists call comparanda, that is comparable text, text that are the text you should compare your text with. And see, remember, we're looking at texts that don't have dates on them. So there's no place on this fragment when it's that says this was written in the year 123. It just isn't there. Sure. And so typically the comparanda, the comparable texts, are dated texts, and they're business papers, they're letters, they're contracts, and they'll say the fourth year of the emperor is so-and-so. Well, we can peg it right to the year, mm-hmm. thanks to that. The papyrus might be older. It might even be reused, you know, so sometimes there's that complexity, but we'll have a date. And so we'll then compare it to the undated text, and we'll say, ah, the handwriting is similar. So that's how we do it. It's a comparative dating. So Obink and Colomo, when they published this as Papyrus 137, I think it is, a fragment of Mark, they dated it late second.
So about 100 years later.
Yeah, about 100 years later. Mm-hmm. And I found it kind of interesting because to this day I scratch my head, and I talk about that in my forthcoming book, Jesus and the Manuscripts. You know, I leave all this legal stuff out. I don't say anything about, you know, there's sure. a criminal investigation. I don't get into that. But I just say it's interesting that initially two papyrologists said it's late first century, early second. But when it's published, one of those papyrologists and a third papyrologist, that'd be Daniela, mm-hmm. say, nah, it's probably late second, early third. And I read carefully. There are two paragraphs or so where they talk about how they dated it. It's not real clear to me. It's not obvious why it should be that late, other than the idea that, my gosh, this is a fragment of Mark. Could we possibly have a fragment that was written only 20 or 30 years
after the original?
Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. I wonder if there's a little bit of this too good to be true psychology at work here. I don't know. I respect them as paleographers. And if they say it's late second, early third, well, then I'm not going to dispute that.
So how does that compare with what we had before? I mean, because this really is the earliest fragment of the Gospel of Mark. Even if it's not late first century, it's late second century, but that's still early.
Yeah, that's true. The you know, we don't have much of Mark. You have, I think it's P88, which is a portion of Mark chapter 2, and it dates to... the late third, early fourth.
Late third, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then you have the two big codices that are fourth century, Vaticanus and Sinaiticus, where you have all of Mark except the last
which
12
verses.
Which is
nearly 200 years, 150 to 200 years
yeah.
later.
Yeah. So it is significant. So it's too bad that all of this, you know, prequel stuff kind of created a letdown. But the fact is, this is a very important discovery. We have a page preserving a few verses of Mark, and it's the oldest fragment we have of Mark. And so I think that is truly noteworthy. It's just a shame it got caught up in all this hubbub
yeah.
and stuff like that.
Scholars are very plain-spoken, straight shooters, aren't they, always?
You know, I hate the blogosphere, I'll tell you. When it was published in March of 2018, immediately a blogger, and I'm not going to give away who he is. I've reached out to him, and I think we're on pretty good terms now. But he was mocking me and said, Evans blew it. He's off by 100 years. And I wrote to him, and I said, so-and-so, you know, you got to know better than that. I'm not the one who dated it. Two Oxford papyrologists dated it to the late first, early second century. I'm only repeating what they said. And of course, there's a lot of high and mighty talk now. I was at the Society of Biblical Literature meeting on textual criticism, and this was just a few months ago in San Diego. Oh, they, you know, up on their soapboxes, holier than thou, pontificating about how shameless this whole thing is, and blah, 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 blah. How naive we all were, how we should always test everything. And my response was, look, if two Oxford papyrologists say something, what would happen if you chose to ignore them? What if you said, oh, well, that's not good enough for me, people would then shame you for, well, what's the matter with you? So, you know, you can't win in the blogosphere.
No, not a good place to be sort of competing, is it? Dr. Craig Evans, thanks for being with us today to talk about this early fragment of the Gospel of Mark.
Thank you.
Thank you to Brent Johnson, our editor. Thanks as well to Phil Keggy for our music. These podcasts are made possible by the generosity of Mark and Becky Lanier and the Lanier Theological Library Foundation. If you have questions, comments, or would just like to be in touch, please email us at podcast@lanierlibrary.org. That's podcast@lanierlibrary.org. Lanier is L-A-N-I-E-R. Thanks for listening.